Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Never in human history has our planet contained so many older people. One in every seven Americans is now over the age of 65. By 2030, it will be one in five. That's 20% of the U.S. population. Given the numbers, it should come as no surprise that the study of adult development and aging is a rapidly expanding field. Dr. Marty Slowinski directs Penn State Center for Healthy Aging, one of many such centers around the country, where he's involved in groundbreaking training, research, and outreach aimed at identifying the underlying pathways to healthy and unhealthy aging. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Healthy aging is a hot topic. Tell us about this rapidly expanding field of study.
Well, there are a number of ways of thinking about this. It used to be when people were thinking about aging, it was conceived of as sort of geriatric issues. How do we keep people from getting sick as they get older? But now we're looking at this in a little bit broader perspective, trying to help people not only avoid illness, but also to maximize their well-being, their sense of purpose, their social connectedness, and maintain an active lifestyle into very old age.
So right now, as I said, 14.5% of the U.S. population is considered elderly, age 65 or older. What percentage of that 14.5% would you say is aging well?
That's a very good question. There's no way to know for sure. What we do know is that people are living not only longer but healthier lives, sort of known as a person's health span. So that has been increasing. The amount of time people spend sick, ill, or frail is actually a smaller percentage of their total lifespan. So more people are living healthy, living well, but there's still a lot of work to do.
The number of seniors is projected to reach 92 million by 2060. And 18.2 million of those people will be 85 or older. So a lot of this interest in healthy aging is fueled by demographics. How has our view of aging and decline changed over the past seven or eight decades? And I ask that because things that were once considered normal, dementia was considered a normal part of aging. We no longer look at it that way.
You know, it's very interesting you asked this question because even this notion that people 65 and above are considered elderly, for our research, they barely even qualify as entering that range. So it certainly is fair to say that 85 is the new 70 in some ways, at least for people, when you look at sort of rates of hospitalization associated with cardiac problems. An 80-year-old now has the heart health of a 70-year-old about 7-8 years ago.
Well, it's funny because elderly boomers exercise twice as much as older people generations ago. So to what extent is realizing what factors are protective, making that change in a heart health that in the 80s that's really like a 70-year-old?
You know, that's a great question. And I think taking a step back, if you kind of think of what do we need to do to age in a healthy way and draw an analogy to child development, we, as a society, have devoted a lot of resources to developing evidence-based programs that are geared at helping younger people grow up. We've devoted far less resources to developing evidence-based programs and learning how to help people grow old. So much in the same way decades ago, you know, educational programs, parenting practices were left to people's intuitions about what has worked for them or people they know. Middle-aged people and older people are left to those same devices, trying to guess what they should be doing at age 40, age 50, age 60 to get them set up to be healthy and productive as they reach older ages.
Well, that sort of brings me to a project that you're involved in at the Center for Healthy Aging at Penn State, the New Pathways T32 program, which is really geared at getting the next generation of scientists to look at the underlying causes of healthy aging and unhealthy aging.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. And in fact, what's unique about this program is it takes a more holistic view of what is healthy and unhealthy aging. So a number of programs at Penn State look at the behavioral, psychological, and social consequences and factors that contribute to healthy aging. Another group of faculty and researchers look at the biological underpinnings of aging. And the purpose of this program is to train the next generation of scientists to be conversant, if not expert, in both types of domains of functioning, the psychosocial as well as the biological.
And this is really critical because research is showing that late life depression or loneliness or being socially disengaged are all risk factors for dementia.
You know, that's true. And what's really interesting is and this is where the blending of the psychosocial and the biological approaches is so important. It's been well established that as people age, their social networks become a little bit more constricted. But in some ways, that's a good thing because they tend to prioritize meaningful social relationships. So they spend more time with their family, with their close friends, and cut out the irritants in their life. So that ends up promoting their happiness, well-being, reducing their stress. But if one social network gets too small, as they reach older ages, they are at risk for social isolation. So the same types of behaviors and practices that made them happier in middle age may place them at risk for adverse outcomes as they get older.
In your book, Adult and Aging, you write about the Roman orator Cicero, who observed, quote, "It is not by muscle, speed, or physical dexterity that great things are achieved, but by reflection, force of character, and judgment. In these qualities, old age is usually not only poorer, but even richer." So I wonder to what extent our attitudes about aging influence whether we experience healthy or unhealthy aging.
Again, a great question, and I think attitudes and stereotypes certainly have changed. What's kind of interesting, if you go back, even look in the popular media or on television shows, and you look at Hollywood's conception of aging. The newer Star Trek show that had Patrick Stewart had an episode where, you know, in real life, I think he was 45 or 50, and they aged him 20 years on the show. And he looked decrepit. You look at him now, which is 25 years later, and he looks amazing. So I think that that kind of speaks to what our conceptions have been and maybe what the possibilities really are.
Well, that's interesting because we have viewed aging as this systemic illness or a disease, this linear depletion of vitality. And that isn't necessarily the case.
It isn't, but we can't also minimize the challenges and the real constraints that we face as we grow older and our bodies age.
So what kinds of changes should we expect as we age? And how important is it that we can adapt to those changes?
Well, you know, it's also interesting when you say what changes should we expect, even those that we expect aren't necessarily written in stone. So what we can expect when we look at people as they grow older, they become less active, they put on a little bit of weight, they maybe lose a little bit of muscle mass, and then this can develop even to more advanced stages. It's sort of sarcopenia, which is sort of age-related loss of muscle mass. All of those changes are to some extent preventable, or at least we can slow them down through lifestyle choices. So what's expected now may not necessarily be the case later on.
So you talked about physical changes. How about mental changes? Because we seem to think that, well, memory losses are a normal part of aging.
Sure, certain types are. And I think it sometimes is difficult to deconfound what's due to aging versus what's due to changes in our social roles and lifestyle versus also what may be a byproduct of being sick, being ill, or being frail. In practice, the types of memory changes we expect to see in normal aging might be of the kind that would make it more difficult for a 70-year-old to go back to college and respecialize in a new degree. Learning new information, drawing those kinds of associations and kind of retaining that. What we shouldn't expect are the kinds of changes in memory function that significantly interfere with our daily activities.
So that begs the question, what can we do to prevent the kind of memory loss that we used to associate as an inevitable part of aging?
So, and this brings me back to the point of what do we know about how best to grow old? And this is an active area of research trying to identify the kinds of behavioral choices people can make to maximize their brain health as they get older. There's been a lot of very interesting observational studies that point to lifestyle factors such as remaining socially engaged, remaining intellectually stimulated, physically active, and especially kinds of activities that integrate at least two of those three components. For example, we published a study, I think it's now 12 years ago, that showed that dancing is one of the most protective factors to slow down rates of cognitive decline and reduce dementia risk.
Why do you suppose that's the case? Is it because of balance and this interplay between balance and space?
Well, you know, as a failed ballroom dancer, I can tell you that this is not an easy activity. So it's this combination of attention, executive function, sort of planning your next move, being aware of your environment. It's physically active because you're moving around. And of course, you don't typically dance by yourself. So there's a social component as well.
Terrific. You know, getting back to Cicero, he viewed aging as a series of losses and gains that can be altered by an individual's choices. You talked about lifestyle a minute ago and behaviors, and I kind of like that idea. And the whole idea behind that, you researchers are talking about it as neuroplasticity. If you take that back to early childhood, we're talking about how plastic and elastic a young brain is, and it sounds like the same is true to a certain extent with an older brain.
True for an older brain and older body to some extent. Again, not nearly as plastic in some respects as, you know, individuals who are younger age, infants, adolescents, children, but significant plasticity still remains. So, you know, a person can turn around their physical health in their 50s, 60s, or even 70s, as well as take active steps to become more mentally or cognitively or socially engaged and see those changes manifest not only in behavior, but in their brain.
It's interesting because Time Magazine's September cover story is on exercise, and there's actually work being done on how we can target specific exercises to prevent specific illnesses.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, and I think the issue when it comes to then what the analogy would be for the brain, mental exercises, the jury is still out on this. What we know we can do with people of almost any age is if we train them in a certain cognitive task using a certain cognitive game, they will get better at that task. They will get better at that game. What is less clear is what we need to do to have those effects generalize to their everyday life. So we train them in a certain brain game, a certain kind of mental exercise. Will that make it easier for them to balance their checkbook? Will it make it easier for them to continue to play bridge into older age? These are the questions that scientists are still trying to grapple with.
And I was really talking about physical exercise, because there is evidence that just 20 minutes a day of exercise can improve the lifespan by a couple of years.
Yeah, and this, again, falls a little bit outside of my domain of specific expertise, but what I expect in the next 5 to 10 years is there going to be a shift in the emphasis on the types of exercise that we really need to do, sort of not just cardiovascular, but a lot more emphasis on resistance training, which helps maintain lean muscle mass and one sense of balance.
And in general, what's good for the heart, they're saying, is good for the brain.
That's true.
Now, you just received funding for another really interesting research program, a large multi-site program called the Einstein Aging Study. And this is aimed at identifying the earliest indicators of preclinical Alzheimer's disease, things that you would see in everyday life. What does it look like in the early stages? And you're using technology in really interesting ways. Tell us something about that.
Yeah, so this is a longstanding project. In fact, I began working on it when I was in graduate school.
Oh, okay.
So I've maintained my collaborations with my colleagues at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. And the project used to be focused just simply on identifying the earliest signs of Alzheimer's disease. But what this project blends is the special expertise we have in Penn State for trying to, using technology and other means, to understand how everyday experiences, everyday behaviors, everyday stresses, how those effects can accumulate over the course of time and pile up to affect our health in the long run. So what this project uses are smartphones and sensors to measure people's behavior, to measure their cognitive function, as well as their cardiac function in the course of everyday life. And the rationale behind this is if we can understand and track those behaviors, we can better understand who's at most risk for developing dementia and maybe step in and help.
And of course, this is much more reliable than an interview where you say to somebody after the fact, well, were you stressed today or was today a very positive day?
That's a very sophisticated point, because that's how 99% of the clinical research is done, asking people how have they been over the last month, the last 6 months. And this is especially interesting in the context of aging, where as we get older, we become much better at reappraising negative situations in a more positive light. So we may end up minimizing the problems we really experienced that we would get at if we asked them in the moment.
And that we really experienced physically. And you know this because
yes.
of the monitoring.
Yes.
We'll find out more about that. If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Dr. Marty Slowinski, a professor of human development and family studies and director of Penn State Center for Healthy Aging, which is currently involved in several large-scale research projects projects, including the Einstein Aging Study and the National Study of Daily Experiences, which I want to talk about next. So in addition to this Einstein study, you're doing this National Study of Daily Experiences, and you're asking participants, and there are lots of them, I don't know the exact number, but you're asking them to keep a diary.
Yeah, so this study is run by Dr. David Almeida in Human Development and Family Studies in Penn State. And this is really the research that spawned the Einstein Aging Study. So you can view that as sort of, you know, the natural consequence of the work that Dave has done. This is a study that recruits people from all across the country. And they do telephone interviews at the end of the day for about 8 days, asking them about what happened during the day, about their stressors, about their social interactions, about their physical behavior. And what he has shown in previous analyses of these types of data is that the degree to which you are emotionally reactive to things like arguments during the day predicts the likelihood of developing problematic health conditions 10 years later.
Interesting. So personality is an important part of how we age. And the interesting thing about personality is the personality we had as a young person isn't necessarily the personality that we have as an older adult.
Again, you know, that's a very sort of modern view. It used to be thought that personality was a relatively fixed disposition, but a lot of work has shown that personality actually is malleable. And, you know, we're still the same person we were when we were younger, but not exactly the same. So we can see changes in personality traits like neuroticism, like openness to experience. And in fact, there's an active line of research, not that we're doing, but that's looking at how to train people to be conscientious.
Well, it's interesting. I've heard lots of people say, oh, Dad is much more mellow now than he was 20 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that's related to the empirical finding that as we get older, we sometimes seek experiences and engage in behaviors that aren't necessarily more negative or positive, but that may be less physiologically activating because we find those states increasingly less comfortable and our body becomes sort of less efficient at recovering from states of high levels of physiological activation.
So what are the major sources of stress for the elderly?
Again, a good question. And, you know, what is stressful changes across the lifespan, right? And it depends on whether you are interested in what are the major sources of big stress, so sort of major life events, and those would be the typical types of things, loss of a spouse, loss of friends, health conditions that necessitate a change in residential status, for example. On a daily level, what we often see is that the most common types of hassles people engage in or stressors are stressors that happen to other people in their social network, other people in their families, their friends, things that are going on around them.
So they're concerned in a way for other people?
Yeah, and it just also could be that if they're retired, they're not going to have a work-related stressor. They're probably not going to have transportation-related stressors because they're not going to get caught in rush hour. So it could also be just an elimination of many other types of sources of stress. And what is maintained, at least to a fair degree, are people's social connections.
Well, let's talk about retirement for a moment, because lots of Penn Staters in the last month got basically a golden handshake.
Yes.
People are going to be retiring earlier than they perhaps anticipated. And there are some risks involved in early retirement because of that loss of engagement. What advice would you have for someone who suddenly is planning to retire?
Well, so that's a, you know, an interesting turn of phrase, suddenly planning to retire. And, you know, my argument would be to say this is not something you should be planning over the course of a month, but something you should be working toward throughout at least much of your middle-aged years. What will I be doing in my second life? And I think certainly you're entitled once you retire to take a month off, sit around and relax. But what you don't want to do is simply view retirement as an opportunity to rest.
Very good. And one of the things that your program, the Center for Healthy Aging, does is provide community lectures. So those people who've retired, they can go back and see faculty members who are involved in cutting edge research on aging and get some tips on living well.
Yeah, we're really excited about these lectures. We've been doing them now for 4 years, and we have quite a local following. We have sometimes over 100 people attending these lectures. And the purpose of the lectures is to bring cutting edge science that our faculty at Penn State, our students at Penn State and at other institutions are doing, and present this in a way that's useful for people in the community and also has some practical application. So we've had lectures on nutrition. We've had lectures on stress management. We've had lectures on brain health. And I think this is part of trying to help educate people on how they can grow old effectively, healthy, and remain socially engaged.
You know, I want to get back to this technology aspect of everything that you're doing, because you've said that this is a really wonderful time for young entrepreneurs. The needs that this older population will have can fuel all kinds of new innovations and inventions.
Yeah, in particular, I think in the fitness industry, when you look at just the amazing innovation that's going on in terms of developing sensors that track our health, often these are geared toward younger people who are on the sort of high end of the athletic and physical activity fitness spectrum. We're trying to adapt these types of approaches and technologies for use in people who are middle and older age, and I think there is a gap between where the innovation is occurring in the industry and an untapped market.
It's interesting how you put that, because older age has become so stratified that we now have the young old, 64 to 74, then the old, 74 to 84, and then the old, which is 85 or older.
Yeah, these are moving targets, and they're useful heuristics, but, you know, there's so much variability in the level of fitness, health, vigor, and vitality among people in, you know, 65 plus, that those categories are useful for talking about groups in general, but not so useful for trying to understand individuals.
You know, I'm kind of curious to know how interested young people are in working with the geriatric population. Those who work with that population often talk about just how rewarding it is. On the other hand, a lot of young people think, oh, I don't want to do anything with older people. For some reason, they just don't have enough interaction with older people to know what it might even be like.
Or the types of interactions they have are forced, non-volitional, in the sense you're going to go visit your older relative now and spend time with them, rather than have those kinds of interactions in ways that are sort of, you know, mutually engaging for all parties. You know, I think this is one thing our center has really tried to focus on by reaching out to our undergraduate population. We've developed some courses that gives applied learning experiences to the undergraduates to give them opportunities to work with seniors. And we've seen many people think they want to work with kids, but then realize, boy, it's way more interesting that they can learn something by talking with people of older ages.
And actually, in a way, they're using the Village at Penn State as sort of a laboratory.
Yes. We have a very close connection with the Village at Penn State, as well as other continuing care retirement centers. We have lots of student activities and research activities we do at those locations and with their residents.
Tell us a little bit about this Face Age multimedia project that you're involved in. I know it's on display at the Hub throughout the fall. I just want to say one thing about one of the subjects that was featured that I thought was so interesting. This is 70-year-old people and older matched with 18 to 22-year-olds. And one of the young men in the study said to the older man, he was asked to touch his face. That's part of this thing. And he said, you know, I never touched my grandfather's face. And the older gentleman had such a reaction to that.
So this is a creation by Andy Belzer, who's in our School of Arts and Architecture. It's just an amazing installation. And it, when you just think about where you're going to have two people sitting next to each other, talking about their physical appearances and touching each other's face, it
sounds a little odd.
Sounds a little odd, but boy, is this impactful emotionally. And this really speaks to the issue of stereotypes, intergenerational discourse, and, you know, trying to break down these perceived barriers that sometimes inhibit younger people from reaching out and connecting with older adults and vice versa.
Mm. So it's having us reimagine old age, and really at all levels.
Yeah, and it's a way for people to see, to have a glimpse into their future.
Interesting. So what are the public implications of the work that you're doing, you know, determining what factors influence healthy or unhealthy aging?
Well, one thing is what we're hoping to do is to be able to bring some of the evidence-based programs that others and we might develop to the community in ways that are affordable and sustainable. That's one implication. Another implication is as we develop more advanced and precise tools, perhaps using mobile technology, perhaps using sensors, to better monitor people in their daily lives, we can maybe do a better job of identifying who is at risk, finding ways to intervene at an appropriate time before a problem occurs, and maybe make recommendations for people and how they should plan for their retirement, not just financially, but also socially, emotionally, and cognitively.
So you mentioned interventions, and that makes me ask, how can society help facilitate positive aging? And why is this something that we should all sort of be interested in?
Well, you know, the reason why this is high stakes for everyone is the proportion, as you mentioned, the proportion of older adults, 65 and above, relative to those younger, what would consider working age, is increasing. So this means the technical term is the dependency ratio, and the elderly dependency ratio is increasing. So if we don't find ways to keep seniors engaged, happy, healthy, and productive members of society, this is a problem that we're all going to have to deal with of any age and any generation.
You know, we often talk about things like Alzheimer's disease, and we're always looking for what drug down the road is going to change the game. But experts like yourself keep saying that lifestyle changes are more promising than any new drug.
You know, whether they're more promising or just as promising, I think we are getting a better idea of what we need to do in terms of lifestyle to promote holistic health in the individual, which of course would have implications for brain health. To the extent it used to be thought that Alzheimer's maybe was just this single disease, and if we find the right drug that hits the one mechanism, we'll have it. Alzheimer's may be a little bit more multi-determined, also may not just be a single condition, but maybe reflect the final outcome of many different types of etiologies. So I do think certainly keeping our eye on what people can do themselves, how we can sort of support healthy brain aging and stave off Alzheimer's disease, not just with a pill, but with social structures and behaviors.
So what are you personally doing to promote your own successful aging, and how do you define successful aging?
Both great questions. So, you know, when I turned 50, I kind of realized, well, everything I'm doing, all my research and the research of others says I better start paying attention to things. So I've decided to make time for myself to exercise. I'm really watching my diet, and this is effortful, but the science suggests they'll have a payoff to this. So it's just sort of now built into my lifestyle. I think what constitutes well-being is being happy and feeling like your life has meaning. And I think being able to maintain both of those, sort of being happy, feeling like you have a purpose into older age, is what's important. And of course, your physical health plays an important role in being able to accomplish that.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Patty.
That was Dr. Marty Slawinski, a professor of human development and family studies at Penn State and director of the Center for Healthy Aging. To find out more about the center, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.